Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now, we have chosen this week to speak a little bit about diabetes. I have noticed a lot of queries coming in on that subject over recent months, and Dr. Eamon is on with us now to talk more about it. Good afternoon, Eamon.
Deirdre, it is a glorious afternoon.
It is absolutely beautiful. Eamon, we were talking an awful lot in this country a few years ago about the obesity epidemic, that our children were getting bigger and heavier, that we ourselves as a nation were getting bigger and heavier, and it seemed that there was a diabetes epidemic as well. Are there any signs that things have improved on that front?
Not really. It's not gone away. I think it's being dealt with slightly better, but the underlying issues are still there all the time. Now, to be fair, there are a lot of people, and I want to give credit where credit is due, there's a lot of people who are making great efforts. There are many, many people who really are being careful, are being really good about lifestyle, and lifestyle does matter. And there are people who are making really good faith efforts to get their weight down. Now, I'm well aware that I'm straying into very difficult areas when we talk about obesity and weight, because for many people this is absolutely toxic topic because it caused them such grief and such distress. But the reality is that unfortunately as a nation we continue to be very large. We're one of the most obese in Europe, not as obese as they are in the United States, and let's call a spade a spade. But the reality is there's a direct linkage between obesity and an extra weight and diabetes, and so you're not going to get one sorted until you try and deal with the other.
Explain the two types that there are. There's type 1 and type 2. Is it type 1 the one that you're genetically born with? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, okay. So, and again, like everything else in life, it's slightly more nuanced than that. So, strictly speaking, type 1 used to be called the so-called insulin-dependent diabetes, and type 2 is the so-called non-insulin-dependent diabetes. As one of my older patients, who's long since passed away, said she had the eating diabetes, and that was the type 2 diabetes. The issue is that with type 1, yes, there are individuals who appear to have a genetic susceptibility. Some as yet undiagnosed factor X, which when combined with some trigger that still has not been identified, it causes the sudden loss of so-called beta cells within the pancreas, which is a gland in behind the stomach that produce insulin, and over a very short period of time all the beta cells disappear permanently, so the person is no longer capable of producing insulin, and without treatment they will die. It's as simple as that. Insulin was first developed and identified in the 1920s by two physicians in Toronto called Banting and Best, and the stories from those days of the impact that giving those, the children who were dying of diabetes, the insulin was just absolutely dramatic. So that's type 1. Type 2 then is the so-called, as I said before, the eating diabetes. People are carrying weight. They become what they call insulin resistant. It seems to be the case that they're producing the same amount of insulin or perhaps even more insulin than people who don't have this condition. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to work as well for a whole bunch of reasons, a whole set of complex reasons. The difficulty is that you have people who start out as type 2 diabetics who become type 1s. It probably doesn't happen the other way around. So it's slightly more nuanced than it was before. Broadly speaking, though, I've got the people who are dependent on insulin and those who are not dependent on insulin.
Okay, and the eating diabetes, as it's as you refer to it there, what would be the signs for you? You know, what would make you suspect that some patient might have type 2 diabetes?
In many cases, I have no suspicion. So I think the big change that happened was about 10 years ago, maybe with 2023, so maybe around 2012 or that way. The way in which our laboratories screen for diabetes changed, and anybody who's got diabetes will be very, very familiar with a measure called the hemoglobin A1C, hemoglobin A1C, or glycosylated hemoglobin, which is a measure of the amount of glucose that's attached to the hemoglobin molecule, the thing that carries oxygen around the body, and it's a reflection of the average levels of sugar in the bloodstream for 2 to 3 months before the blood test. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is that most of the diabetics we're diagnosing today are on the basis of a raised HbA1c. The person themselves has no symptoms whatsoever. If you had untreated type 2 diabetes, and indeed if you have the type 1 diabetics where it happens much more rapidly, the classic symptoms of diabetes would be sudden, unexplained weight loss, voracious thirst, and especially passing loads and loads of urine due to the excess glucose in the urine. Sometimes we'll see people presenting with abdominal pain, but like I said, it's exceptionally rarely that we'd see that in the so-called type 2 diabetics today. We will see it from time to time in the newly diagnosed type 1s, but not the type 2s.
And type 2, of course, is reversible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. There is evidence, and really good evidence, to show that for many, but maybe not necessarily everybody, but for many people who have type 2 diabetes, particularly in the earlier stages, if weight loss is achieved, you can normalize that, you could actually reverse it. So the thinking was, until about 6 or 8 years ago, that once you had type 2 diabetes, there was no going back. But then really good evidence, really good science show that, in fact, if you lose weight, if you have normalized the blood sugars, what in actual fact is, the beta cells that were being lost are reversed and go back and become and reappear. And so I have a number of people who have made huge changes to lifestyle, have lost significant amounts of weight, and essentially have cured themselves of diabetes.
So what changed?
Type 2 diabetes.
No, I was going to say, what changes? Obviously losing weight, but are there other lifestyle changes?
No, not particularly. It is the key is losing weight, and that's the hardest thing in the world, and that's the problem. The difficulty is trying to achieve motivation and helping people to lose weight. Now, I really need to step back from this for a minute and say this is a societal issue. This is a societal issue. This is something that needs to be tackled at the level of government. It's something that needs to be tackled at all the various layers of society, but absolutely right all the way to the top. And we need to start looking at our policies in terms of providing food for individuals. And the difficulty is that there are unhealthy food choices that are very cheap. So people will use unhealthy food choices. And the difficulty is we need to start moving in this. It's akin to the move in terms of encouraging people to stop smoking, which is having a positive impact on people's health. We need to start thinking about what are we doing as a society to help everybody, but especially those people who are challenged with their weight at the moment, to try to help them to lose weight.
Okay, what about children and diabetes? Again, coming back to a few years ago, we were hearing that a lot of young children were being diagnosed with type 2. Is there any change there? Are things improving a bit?
Yes and no. I mean, we would say to a certain extent it wasn't common and it's still not common, but you will see teenagers who are very overweight who are developing diabetes. It's not common, but it hasn't gone away either. And again, it's directly related to just carrying huge amounts of extra weight.
Okay. Eamon, I notice, and we've spoken about it on the show before, there is a lot of help for people here in the community who have diabetes. There's specialist diabetic nurses, for example, that they can go to get themselves checked out.
Okay, I think one of the big changes that's happened is that this is something that's kind of happened without much too much fanfare, but about 4 or 5 years ago, the government, the HSE, and the Irish Medical Organisation entered into an agreement whereby there is a so-called chronic disease management programme. So chronic diseases are diseases that go on over a person's lifetime. And this was introduced for 2018 initially for people over 75, but right now it extends all the way down to age 18. Now, again, to be fair, this applies only to people who've got medical cards. It doesn't apply to everybody. But for those people who have medical cards, what it is, it's a structured management program. So in other words, people who have diabetes will be seen twice a year, and they will then be helped and encouraged and have their treatment adjusted and so on and so forth to try to help them to address the issues surrounding their diabetes. And the reason for this, quite simply, is that there is significant ill health associated with diabetes, and it actually benefits the state to make these kind of investments to reduce the number of people who end up in hospital because of the complications of diabetes.
Yeah, well, you kind of took the words out of my mouth there for in your last answer, because I was going to ask you about illnesses and conditions that diabetics are more susceptible to than the general community, we'll say.
The simplest way to put it is that diabetes attacks the circulation, and the difficulty is that it attacks the circulation throughout the whole body. It does vary from person to person, but it attacks the very smallest little blood vessels. It can affect the brain, the eyes, the kidneys, the feet. and a number of other organs. So the thing is that, oh, of course, the heart. Prior to, say, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, when I started in treatment, most diabetics didn't live beyond their mid-60s because they all had massive heart attacks and they died from their heart attacks. We don't see that at all as much today because of the advances in treatment. But it is still primarily a problem to do with circulation affecting different people in different parts of their body.
Why is it that some people who are diabetic have to make sure that they have snacks in their handbag or whatever so that they eat regularly?
That's the type 1 diabetics. They're the type 1 diabetics because the treatment there, by definition, involves giving the person insulin. Now, there are, broadly speaking, two kinds of insulin. There are long-acting insulins and short-acting insulins. And for most type 1 diabetics, it would be a combination of the two. The thing is that if somebody has a prolonged fast or if they do too much exercise, if they use up too much energy, they might have an excess, slight excess of insulin in their system, which will lead their blood sugars to falling to very low levels, a situation that's technically referred to as hypoglycemia, or a hypo for short. And under those circumstances, the person needs a quick fix of glucose to bring their sugar levels back into the normal range. The point being that our brain can only operate with glucose. It can't use anything else. And if we don't have enough glucose, we'll just faint.
So are the people, am I right in interpreting what you're saying in the way that the people with type 2 have to be very careful about sugary foods, but the people with type 1... it's a different scenario, or have I got it wrong?
Well, okay, so people with type 1 diabetes are the individuals who have type 1 diabetes. One of the things they need to be careful of is that their blood sugars don't go too low. As a rule, although there's always exceptions, but in the vast majority of cases, people with type 2 diabetes don't have that problem, particularly with the newer medications, which are much, much less likely to cause what are called hypos. So it is the type 1s, people with type 1 diabetes are the people who are more likely to develop this hypoglycemic episode, and therefore they need to carry around something with them to give them a quick glucose fix.
Okay. Right, Eamon, we'll take a short break. We have some questions for you. Just to put it to the listeners, we will prioritise questions about diabetes this afternoon. But when we get through those, if we have time, we will come to other more general queries. To contact us, it's 083 300 3300, which is also the WhatsApp line as well as the text line. And if you prefer to make a phone call, remember, we could do with plenty of detail your age, what sex you are exactly, etc. That will help Eamon give a more comprehensive answer. And the phone number is 066-712-3666. Just coming up to 17 minutes past.
Medical Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Bonsecours Hospital Tralee. Celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Welcome back. We're talking about diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, with Dr. Eamon Shanahan on this week's Medical Matters slot. Eamon, we'll come to some questions. And before I put the first one to you, there's a listener out there who sent in a text, and I'm not quite following it. It just looks to me like the person says, I'm a 60-year-old diabetic. What advice would you give me? This comes in from N, but I suspect that there might be more to that text. So the person who texted in as N, you might send us on a bit more information about what specifically you want to ask Dr. Eamon. We'll start with this one, Eamon. A lady in her 60s has type 2 diabetes. She says, I've been getting bruises on my toes. Should I be worried about this?
Yeah, I suppose part of the reason for that is that one of the concerns for people who have diabetes is that they're being constantly told, be careful of your feet, be careful of your feet. Now, the reason for that is because one of the problems you get with diabetes, both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, is that it can affect the circulation to your feet, and that in turn can make you more prone to things like ulcers and things like that. Now, again, as part of the diabetes management program, one of the things that people will have, they'll have their feet checked twice a year. Nurses will do is they will check the circulation, but they'll also check your sensation, because loss of sensation can be an early warning that you're having a problem with the circulation. Now, the thing is that if your nurses are saying to you that your circulation is okay, the bruising may be related to something else. For example, a lot of people with diabetes have other related conditions. For example, they may well have circulatory problems, and then in those circumstances they may possibly be taking aspirin, which will definitely make you more prone to bruising. The short answer is, as long as your circulation is okay, as long as your nurses are saying your feet are all right, then it's not a cause for concern.
Now, that 60-year-old lady, thankfully, has been back to us, and I've sorted out what she was trying to ask. It was just the text got jumbled. She's, as I said, a 60-year-old lady. She's been told she's pre-diabetic and is wondering what advice you would give her. What's pre-diabetic?
Yeah, I'm a bit cynical about pre-diabetes. I really do believe this is something manufactured by drug companies. The idea behind it is that you've got you're in this so-called impaired glucose tolerance range. So I spoke earlier on about the hemoglobin A1C, and if your hemoglobin A1C is 42 or less, you do not have diabetes. It's 48 or over, you have diabetes. If it's between 42 and 48, you have this so-called you have this impaired glucose tolerance. You're beginning to have difficulty managing your blood sugars. So the message there is, it's go back to look at lifestyle, do if possible, try and lose weight if it's at all possible. The reason for my cynicism is because a number of years ago, one of the drug companies tried to push the agenda that, oh, if you take our product, we can stop you developing diabetes. And so they were providing a solution to something that wasn't already a problem. Long story short, if the person is able to, with the assistance of their GP, and there are HSE-funded dietetic services out there, if they can help to lose a bit of weight, then this issue is going to go away, simple as.
Now, still on that subject, Eamon, and very closely related to what you've just said, a 70-year-old female has been in touch. She's a smoker and she's overweight. She says, my diabetes blood is 48. My doctor says that's okay, but I've been talking to people who are telling me it's not. What does Eamon think?
Okay, so what if it is the hemoglobin A1C, and that's the bit that we need to be clear about, but if it's the hemoglobin A1C, it means that at 48 you're just on the cusp of having diabetes. And okay, it's better than 58 or 68 or 78, and that's the good news. The bad news is you're a smoker, because the problem is that being a smoker and the diabetes absolutely hugely amplifies the bad effects of each other. If you were to do nothing else except stop smoking, that actually would reduce your risk hugely. So the lifestyle change for this person is stop smoking.
Okay, as simple as that.
Yeah.
Now, Eamon, another one about diabetes before we move on to other questions. A listener wants to know, how do you get tested for type 2 diabetes? You kind of hit on that already, didn't you?
Yeah, again, it's this thing called a hemoglobin A1C. Kind of, there are no hard and fast rules, but sort of from the middle years of life onwards, and especially if somebody is carrying a bit of extra weight, and if they have a family history, of diabetes, it's a simple enough test to do, and you can check in it. And if you're, again, go back to repeat the figures, if you have a figure of 42 or less, you're not diabetic. If you have a figure of 48 or more, you are a diabetic. And if you're between 42 and 48, you're kind of on track heading for diabetes, but there still is time to do something about it.
A male listener who's 76 has type 2 diabetes. The nurse told him not to take his bloods, which he had been taking himself from the top of his finger two or three times a week. Yeah. What does the doctor think?
Yeah. The answer to that is that if you're newly diagnosed diabetic, and if you get one of these glucometer things, it's useful to check your blood sugars as a feedback. So, classic example, I've told the anecdote many times before. A long time ago, one of my patients came into the Dr. Eamon, and I knew there was that much sugar in a slice of apple pie. She took her blood sugars after she did the slice of apple pie, which of course was laced with sugar, and it drove her blood sugars up. So it can be very useful at the start in terms of giving people a guidance as to how they can change their diet to get their blood sugars down. But after a while, it doesn't actually make any difference. And all you're doing is driving the person mad, and it's an uncomfortable dose pricking their fingers. The hemoglobin A1C, the test we would do, is the one that will tell us how they're doing overall. And again, I have to differentiate between people who have type 2 diabetes and people who have got type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetics do need to monitor their blood sugar regularly. And in fact, of course, where things have moved to now for the type 1 diabetics in the last couple of years is there are things called continuous glucose monitors, a patch that fixes onto the arm or somewhere at the upper arm. There's a tiny little needle that comes out in a bit of it, and basically what happens is it transmits if you use your smartphone anywhere near it, it will continuously transmit your glucose readings. And for type 1 diabetics, this can be very useful for helping them to adjust their insulin. So I would draw the difference between the type 2 diabetics, who probably don't need to be checking their blood sugars on a regular basis, and the type 1 diabetics, who need to check them all the time.
Now we're back to a similar question to one we had a few questions ago. This time, a 63-year-old male, the doctor told him he was borderline diabetic. He's wondering what kind of foods should he cut back on.
best thing to do there is talk to a nutritionist or a dietitian. The thing is that what I can do is I can talk about the general principles in terms of trying to reduce your calorie intake, but I can't tell you what you should have for your breakfast, dinner and tea. Your GP can refer you to, there's HSE funded dietetic services throughout the county, and the services have improved out of all order over the last 10 years, and they will go through your diet in great detail and they'll advise you very specifically what to do. One simple tip is be aware of the amount of sugar in alcoholic drinks. So people having a couple of pints every weekend, that in itself can make all the difference.
Okay, yeah, and I suppose that's not something a lot of people will want to hear, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
Eamon,
yeah.
We'll finish up with one or two general queries because covered the diabetic ones. This is from a West Limerick listener. He's 73, very fit, does a lot of cycling and a lot of walking. But he says, over the last 6 months, he's developed shortage of breath. He said, every test under the sun, including an angiogram, everything has shown up negative. He has slight dizziness and fatigue. There are other problems. Now, he says, I've had COVID twice, but I've had all my boosters. And now I'm wondering, could I be suffering from long COVID? I feel I also need to check my neck arteries for dizziness, etc.
Yeah. Okay, there's a couple of things going on there. Breathlessness can be related to heart disease, but oftentimes is not. And I mean, what I haven't heard there is that has there been an assessment done of lung function, especially in light of the fact that you've had COVID twice? What's your lung function like? And see what the story is there.
Yeah, he says he's had lung tests. I presume that's lung function.
Okay. And that's fair enough, and that's maybe one way of assessing it. Yet the difficulty is, it may very well be, the difficulty is that, unfortunately, and it's an area where there is still a huge amount of research going on. If you remember the very early parts, go back three and a half years ago now, at the start of COVID, the big problem was the fact that the infection, the virus attacked the lungs, and a lot of people died because of what's called respiratory failure. And that's still something that we're still working out at the moment. Certainly it's pragmatic and it's not science based, but what a lot of people are doing, myself included, are that if we're finding people who have had COVID and are breathless, what we're doing them is giving them asthma treatment, specifically an inhaled steroid, as this seems to help relieve their symptoms for them. But as I have to stress, that's pragmatic and there isn't the science behind it yet.
Are you seeing a lot of people with long COVID, Eamon?
Not a lot, but a number. Not a lot, but a number. The thing is that if you think about it, the waves of COVID, the last big waves would have been 6-12 months ago at this stage. And the thing is that for a lot of people, the further away you get from the original incident, from the COVID itself, the less and less people have the symptoms or have symptoms derived from the COVID. The thing is that there is a handful of people who will continue to have symptoms and seem to have symptoms, if not indefinitely, then for long periods of time. But they become a smaller and smaller number as time goes on.
A female in her 70s is wondering, how important is it to get the shingles vaccination?
It's a really good idea. Is it absolutely necessary? Possibly not, but at the same time, shingles is a horrible dose, and the thing is that what the vaccine will do is boost your immunity and reduce substantially your risk of getting this very nasty condition.
Okay, sorry now for all the shuffling of paper here, Eamon.
Not a problem.
A 75-year-old male was in touch. He said he details what he's on. First of all, he's on aspirin, cholesterol and blood pressure tablets. Last night he had a cup of tea, a small glass of water and a tin of Guinness. Stopped drinking anything at 8 o'clock. And he says from 1 a.m. to 8 a.m. he went to the toilet to urinate 12 times. Normally he would go, on a normal night, he might go 5 or 6 times. And he says he's finding that he can't drink very much or he would be going to the toilet very often. Normally 5 or 6 times and 12 times last night.
Yeah, and two or three things. Firstly, the fact that he's going as often as he is, he definitely has symptoms of what's called prostatism. He's got an enlarged prostate and that's the reason why he's going so often. Secondly, the thing is that the fact that it came on as suddenly as it did, it is more than likely that he's a bladder infection, that he has cystitis, and that's the reason why he's going so often. So the thing to do is check with your GP. Thirdly, very occasionally you get people who get an irritation of the bladder from alcohol, and the only thing that will relieve it is not drink alcohol. But I'm thinking myself from the description is probably the second thing, that in a person who already has is going very often, the bit of infection is then tipped them over the edge, and that's the reason why they're going, that he has been going so often last night.
Okay. No harm to get checked out, as you said. Eamon, we better leave it there, but thank you for that very comprehensive A to Z of diabetes there, and hopefully we were able to give some information and help and advice to people out there who have it. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Please, God, take care.
That's Dr. Eamon Shanahan there joining us from Farron 4 with this week's Medical Matters. Hopefully you got the information you needed, and sorry if we didn't get around to your query. Now,